the mystery missile off the coast of California. Something or nothing.
I have a great fear that this is really something. The United States government has come out and said, and not quite definitively enough for me, said that this was probably, that is their word, probably an airplane. Probably doesn't make it. We both watched the event. I think this could be aliens.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
And this is, it's very scary. The other thing, the missile went up. When does the missile come down? More importantly, where does the missile come down?
You would put in a call to President Blair Underwood. I knew that you would think
that's right.
that these beings were like 94% human air flying.
No, if it comes down
this
in
is
your
nothing.
Head?
This is a movie promo out of Southern California.
Oh, no.
That's all it is
a
marketing campaign reality.
Really?
It is nada.
Absolutely nada. Wilbon's right.
Nothing.
It's falling off the table there. The missile's nothing. Wilbon gets the win.
This was definitely something. I'm
this game.
Let's jump to this part, because I did want you to follow up on this. You said that you have like a criteria for a UFO movie, so at least get that sort of on the record. Maybe we can dig into it a little bit. So what do you, it sounds like you, just saying you have a criteria, it sounds like there's some that are excluded or some that are certain or what. So how do you shape it down?
My definition of a UFO movie is as follows. Any movie that taps directly into any aspect of UFO mythology or notably draws inspiration from ufological literature, incorporating into its plot references to frequently debated ufological phenomena, events, locales, as well as specialized ufological terminology. A UFO movie need not be about UFOs per se, nor feature traditional ufological iconography, but it will nevertheless often devote a respectable amount of its running time to the dramatization of imagined human-alien interactions, usually, though not always, in the context of a first contact scenario in which the extraterrestrials assume the role of visitor-invader. In other words, the UFO movie frequently is concerned with the problems inherent from a human perspective in earthly encounters with extraterrestrials. So I basically don't look at space opera, so Star Trek doesn't really fall into my purview, under my purview.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certain episodes of Star Trek which would be classed as UFO products, and certain aspects of series like Babylon 5 and Star Trek do really tap into UFO literature. But overall, they're more traditional space opera. The UFO movie is where you have, generally speaking, first contact scenarios between humans and aliens, and the political, cultural, or otherwise dramatic implications of that contact.
Right. So you're saying, like, it doesn't just have to be something going on in space. It has to involve humans, too. It has to be about the relationship between humans and this mystery.
Right, because that's what the UFO phenomenon is. It's our attempt to understand and make sense of this phenomenon.
Right. So like, Star Wars is out. You don't really care about
Star Wars
that.
Is out.
Because stuff that takes place in this fictional out, yeah, I see exactly what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. That parses down a lot of what you'd probably have to look at anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. It would have just been unmanageable. I mean, of course, loads of films look at aliens in a space opera context. And having said that, I do look at, I've got a whole chapter in the book that I'm writing which looks exclusively at alien contact beyond Earth. So it's looking at the mysteries of outer space, but it's looking at human contact in the final frontier. Essentially, it's not where that contact and the fallout of that contact is not restricted to terra firma, not restricted to the Earth. It's actually sort of, so you're looking at films like
Mission to Mars.
Mission to Mars, Apollo 18, films of that ilk.
Yeah. I tried not to, I didn't want to go into this and just throw like every, you know, all these movies at you and be like, well, tell me about this, what about this, you know, because first of all, I find that I really don't, I give you kudos, because I find I don't really like UFO movies too much, just because I feel like they're either patronizing or poorly, you know, or the facts get all discombobulated.
I agree. It's an incredibly frustrating experience having to watch them all. I own pretty much all of them on DVD, and I have them all organized in chronological order so I can see how the genre is, that the subgenre has progressed since 1950 through to present day. and see what trends emerge. But yeah, a lot of them are very tedious. There are some classics, obviously, in there, but a lot of them are very tedious and very frustrating to watch as well.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But the one movie that I did actually want to mention was this was District 9, because I thought that was one of the rarest sort of UFO alien movies I've seen in a long time, because it's a completely different take on. I'd never seen sort of the alien as less than human. The alien's almost always portrayed as more than human. And in District 9, it was the alien was below the human race, it seemed like, evolutionary-wise or something. It was very bizarre in that regard. I wonder what you think of that.
Well, first of all, the District 9 will receive only limited mention in my work because it's not a Hollywood movie. It's a South African-produced film.
Oh, okay.
Which is why it's so different and so refreshing in many ways. Yeah, so it's a South African film, and of course it's an apartheid allegory, a very blatant one. So it's a very political film, a very interesting film. I agree, you never see them. The only Hollywood product that I would remotely compare to that would be Alien Nation, of course, where you had the aliens arrive and they have to integrate into society and struggle to do so because they're seen as inferior or viewed with great suspicion, at least. So there was a similar thing there. Neil Blomkamp's film District 9 was very interesting. And it actually did tap into certain aspects of UFO mythology as well. You've got the idea of the government trying to understand and utilize extraterrestrial technology to weaponize it. Of course, there's all sorts of allegations about that in the UFO field as well. So I thought that was quite interesting. What I also find interesting is how pretty much what you'll find in almost all UFO films, but not all, is the iconography of the flying saucer or a take on the flying saucer.
Yeah.
So sometimes you'll get the classic flying saucer, like in The Day the Earth Stood Still. Sometimes you'll get a slightly different, more elaborate flying saucer, like in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, or a more elaborate one, like we've just talked about, District 9.
Yeah.
And a lot of people tried to take that basic shape and make it really extraordinary, but still holding on to that, that motif.
Right, the saucer.
Well, exactly, because people have expectations. So the UFO, I call it a subgenre because it really is. It has developed its own conventions over the years. It's a distinct subgenre of science fiction, and we have expectations of what a UFO movie is, even if we don't think to call it a UFO movie. We kind of do have expectations about how the narrative is going to develop and what's going to play out. And again, that plays a huge part in programming us to for what to expect when contact, if and when contact does occur. Again, I think it's going to be very difficult to separate our cinematic, memories from our real time expectations. Which is really why I think that the UFO subject with regard to Hollywood is so significant. It's an overlooked area, Hollywood's representations of UFOs. I think most people kind of push it to the sidelines in the field of UFO research because it is seen as a bit trivial. But actually, I think that people really need to start looking at it much, much more closely because, as the world changes with regard to UFOs, we can look to Hollywood's representations over the years and really probably pick apart how our expectations and perceptions have been formed and then, in turn, hopefully gain a greater understanding of what we're actually presented with.
Now, you raise an interesting point there. I never even think about these sort of things, but you say District 9, that's a South African film. And being in the UK, have you seen... I know you look at the Hollywood movies, but you live in the UK, so I assume you have a UK film that only gets around in the UK is hard for people in America to get. Do you know what I mean? Especially the TV and stuff. I mean, the UK has a lot of great TV, and here it's very selective what we get to see of your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see a difference in the portrayal of UFOs and stuff from things that are strictly in the UK. And I guess I'm going to piggyback that with a second, with additional question here. Is there, do you think, the same sort of influence in the UK going on by their MI6, you know, to sway things in the, you know, in the public discourse?
Good question. First part of the question was, what were you asking there?
Portrayal of UFOs, is it different from here in America?
No, the answer is no, because the UK, because UK filmmakers and the UK film industry, such as it is, it really isn't an industry, but what we have takes its cues from Hollywood, as do most film industries, to some extent. Obviously, we have our own style of filmmaking here, we have our own, you know, kind of genres almost, so to speak. But when it comes to blockbuster type entertainment, we emulate what Hollywood puts out, because that's the only way we know how to do it. So you'll have films like Attack the Block, which came out last year, which was the British alien invasion film, which received, I think, very limited distribution in the United States, but was a very big success here, and it had critical acclaim here. It was about a bunch of teenage thugs who have to fight off an alien invasion in a council estate in London, in a city, London. And so that was quite a novel idea, and it was successful. But stylistically, it was entirely owed everything to, you know, to classic Hollywood filmmaking.
Yeah.
Because that's what, that's the only thing we know how to do. We emulate what Hollywood does. So no, the portrayals are no different. The aliens are malevolent, generally speaking. But of course, I think a lot of people think that Paul, the film Paul that came out with Simon Pegg.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that's a British film. And of course, the British film industry, the UK government would tell you it's a British film, but it's a British film only in name. The company that produced it, Working Title, a lot of people think that's a British company, but it's actually entirely owned by Universal.
Oh wow!
So it's not. It's an American company, and although it's staffed with British people, it's ultimately owned by an American corporation.
Yeah.
And the filmmaking, the style of the filmmaking in Paul, of course, is classic Hollywood. Owes a great deal to Spielberg and all the Hollywood, the great Hollywood filmmakers. And it's you know, set in America, features a half American cast. You know, you've got Simon Pegg and. Oh my gosh, my brain's gone blank. I do apologize.
I always forget that other guy's name too. The fact.
I'm sure he's off because it's always Simon Pegg and the other guy.
I know. I feel bad now.
But anyway, he's great in it. But
Yeah, he's excellent. He's good in all the movies.
But yeah, so it's really not. We like to claim what we can as British because we put out so few good films, frankly, nowadays. But it's not really a British film. But it's a good film, and it's very refreshing because it is one of these rare films in which an ET is portrayed as being, you know, benign, benevolent, if not necessarily hugely enlightened, then at least not invasive.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, what about that other part of the question? Do you think the government in the UK is playing the same kind of tricks that the American government is? I assume they are. I mean, what? Why wouldn't they?
Okay, well, one of the reasons why they wouldn't, I think that possibly that's gone on at points. One of the main reasons why they wouldn't, in a big way, is simply because we do not put out enough product to justify that kind of involvement and manipulation. You know, you can probably count the number of UFO movies that Britain has put out on one hand, you know, in the last 50 years. Whereas Hollywood's pumping them out one a month or more than that at the moment. So there's not a great deal that intelligence agencies need to be monitoring or seeking to influence from our end, whereas it's an entirely different story in America. So that's really the overriding reason why they wouldn't necessarily be seeking to influence stuff, because there's just not much stuff to influence. As for MI6 and other intelligence agencies' involvement in British product, this is something that my colleague, Dr. Matthew Ulford, and I have talked about on many occasions. We've always said we need to really look into this. We need to look into what's going on in the UK because we're so focused on America. And we never do. And the truth is that almost no one has. I don't doubt for a second that it goes on. But I don't think it's as pervasive as in America. But it's certainly worth looking at, but it's something that I just haven't, to be quite honest, looked at myself.
Yeah. Well, you figure it's going on in a lot of places too. Of course.
You know. I mean, the point is that any government, any power structure is going to recognize the enormous influence of cinema on the popular consciousness. They're going to recognize that people do take their cues from media and frighteningly from entertainment media in a lot of cases. And so if you want to control how people think, how people perceive you as an institution, then you better get yourself involved in that industry and start tweaking. If you're not, then you're not doing your job. I know if I was in control of if I was some kind of a president, prime minister, or authority figure, I would want to make sure that, if I was of the variety that we currently have, who are all corrupt, I would certainly want to very closely monitor and control how the masses perceive me and my regime. And I mean, it makes sense.
No, I know. I'm just laughing at. I'm imagining you with a regime now.
So, leaders from around the world have always sought to manipulate entertainment media for their own purposes in all sorts of countries. And you look at Nazi Germany and their propagandists and their filmmakers. Obviously despicable, but genius at the same time with what they did and how they managed to manipulate people's perceptions of their goals and what they represented in the world. And Leni Riefenstahl, who was Hitler's Hitler's main filmmaker, really. She's, although she was a Nazi, recognized by many filmmakers around the world as being, one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. And technically speaking, she is, and in a purely objective way, in terms of how she put stuff together, she was a genius.
Yeah, Triumph of the Will, right?
Triumph of the Will is just astonishing to watch, but also extremely disturbing for obvious reasons. So it just goes to show how powerful a medium cinema can be. And, you've just got to watch who has influence over it.
Exactly. You got to keep an eye on who's behind the camera.
Right, precisely. So, so it makes sense that over the years, power structures always sought to be involved in filmmaking and entertainment media. And, in America, this goes back it goes back about 100 years. But especially in World War II, when you had the president basically co-opt Hollywood for the propaganda effort, and dozens of filmmakers, biggest names in the industry, John Ford, John Wayne, Frank Capra, all just willingly gave themselves over to the government and said, yeah, we'll make propaganda films for you, we'll make whatever you want. You tell us, we'll do it. It's all for the good of the country. And maybe it was. I mean, that's up to individual interpretations. But the point there was that the government recognized that the way to reach people was through entertainment media. And, so don't be in any doubt that, those in the corridors of power recognize the influence of cinema.
Right, exactly. And once they got their tentacles in during the war, even if it was for good reasons, you can be sure that they didn't just pull out after the war.
Exactly. They're not going to say, well, that worked well. Let's,
keep in touch.
Draw a line under that and move on.
Yeah.
of course. And as I say, the CIA became very, very heavily involved in the early 50s. And they maintain to this day that they have no involvement beyond their public relations office, beyond their Hollywood liaison office. But if you believe that, then, well.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So you've simply got to be involved. If you've got people, it's my view, and I'm writing this up in a more articulate way than I'm surely going to voice now, but I think it makes sense that the CIA today has operatives, assets, shall we say, at every level of the entertainment industry, from top to bottom. Now, that's not to say that everyone in the entertainment industry is CIA. Of course they're not. We're talking about maybe a couple of dozen people in Hollywood tops.
Mm.
That's all you need.
Exactly.
You have those people at choke points, at levels of influence from top to bottom, and you can make certain calls, you can enact certain changes, and you can have the influence that you want to have. You have a presence, and so I do think there is involvement. It's covert, and that goes beyond the remit of its liaison office.
Now, aside from what we already kind of talked about with regards to how Hollywood needs aliens or needs bad guys, if you will, what do you ascribe to this huge influx of UFO movies that we've seen in the last few years? I mean, is it something involving, you know, fear from terrorism, you think, or the economy? Is it a situation like that where, you know, I studied film in college, so it's, you know, and I'm reaching back here in my mind, and I remember that, you know, I think they were telling me back then that, during downtimes of the economy, gangster movies were really popular. I think during the war, it was like Westerns or something like that. So, I mean, are we seeing this huge amount of UFO movies because of something going on in the culture, you know, beyond that has nothing to do with UFOs, maybe?
Film studies theorists would absolutely say that, and I don't discount that. Obviously, that's part of it. But people stress that too much, I think. In the 50s, of course, in film studies, well, today, in film studies, people look back at the 50s and say that alien invasion films, the flying saucer movies of the 50s, were a direct reflection of fears of communism and of the atomic age, of the bomb, you know, and they were manifestations, these aliens are manifestations of our fears of communism and nuclear war.
Yeah.
Sounds good. And obviously, without question, some of the films were concerned with that as peripheral threads or even as overriding themes. However, people overlook the main influence behind these films, and that's flying saucers. People were making films about flying saucers because thousands of people were seeing flying saucers. People were upset that, you know, the government was in a panic, absolute panic, as shown through declassified documentation. You know, they were, military personnel were reporting these things flying at 27,000 miles an hour over their classified nuclear bases at Los Alamos, and, you know, they were absolutely terrified. They didn't know what these were. They knew they weren't Russian, and they seemed to speculate, although not explicitly, that these things didn't originate on Earth. And in fact, the estimate of the situation, which was drawn up in 1948, which Edward Ruppelt discussed in his book, that concluded, this is the Air Force, the Project Sign concluded that it was almost certainly interplanetary, and most of the reports were burned. But, and of course, Ruppelt saw one and reported on it. But, they were terrified, and it was it swept the nation, swept the world, but especially America. So people, filmmakers were making films about flying saucers, first and foremost, because people were seeing flying saucers. It's as simple as that. And yes, of course, the themes about communism were threaded in there, absolutely. But we shouldn't, you know, discard the idea that these films were just direct reflections of what was actually happening. So, you know, the film critic and author Peter Biskind, who wrote Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, he actually discusses the idea of allegory in alien invasion films of the 50s. And he actually says that, you know, he points out that, you know, critics of pop culture always are quick to note that the other, you know, with the capital O in films is always other than itself, which is to say that, you know, the pods and blobs,
right,
in the 50s are always symbols standing for something else. And obviously, to an extent, that's true. But Biskind, actually, to his credit, also argues that these critics often give science fiction B-movies of the 50s too much credit, and that many of these films actually weren't allegories at all, but were literal reflections of cultural preoccupations, i.e. flying saucers.
Right.
And he suggested that, you know, if you want the preferred reading of many of these films, if you want, you know, what they're actually about, all we have to do is look at what's on the screen before us. It's about flying saucers, and that's what it's about. And I think the same can be said today, actually. There are more flying saucer films being produced today than since the 1950s, than in any other decade since the 1950s. And in fact, there are more being produced today than in the 1950s.
Yeah.
But there's never been this many. Why is that? Well, people are obsessed with UFOs. People are becoming more and more interested, not just in UFOs, but in the idea of extraterrestrial life. We are seeing more and more news reports, scientific studies, discussions, debates about the idea of ET life and the possibility, indeed the probability now, that we are not alone in the universe. More and more extrasolar planets are being discovered. The scientists now estimate that every star in our galaxy, and in turn every star in the universe, probably has at least one planet orbiting it. And this is, you know, this is an astonishing revelation. And it drastically increases the chances that we are not alone. And more people are starting to come around to the idea that, maybe there is other life out there. And of course that feeds the mind. And certainly it's inspiration for Hollywood creatives. And, so where do they go for inspiration about alien life? Well, they look at UFO literature. Because, you know, scientific reports aren't particularly exciting, but UFO literature is. So they mine the literature. I interviewed the film director Andy Fickman, who directed Race to Witch Mountain, the 2009 Disney film. And this is a classic example. You know, he was born and raised in Roswell, New Mexico. He's a self-described UFO buff, and he practically wrote the script for the film himself. And he told me that, you know, he really actively put as much ufological fact, shall we say, ufological debate into that film as he possibly could, because he wanted it to be an educational tool, strangely enough. He wanted people to engage seriously with UFOs, and he wanted it to be serious. Disney wanted the film to be very silly, and he fought very hard to make it a little bit more serious, even though it's a family film. So you've got real people from the UFO community in there. You've got, you know, Willy Streber, you've got Roger Lear and others who appear in that film as themselves. You've got books on cattle mutilation appearing in there. You've got all sorts of debates and terminology like Moondust and Project Moondust. And, you know, so it's a very interesting film from a ufological standpoint. And, of course, that's because, you know, he's just looking at the literature. And he's not alone in that regard. Many other filmmakers do this as well. In fact, most of them do. And this is why I say it's a cultural process. The film, which hardly anyone seems to have seen, called The Objective, which was released in 2010.
Yeah, I don't even know. I've never even heard of that one. Yeah.
It was directed by Daniel Myrick, who was one of the co-directors of the Blair Witch Project.
Okay.
And it's a film, it got a theatrical release. It's quite a low-budget sci-fi about troops in Afghanistan who accompany a CIA operative in Afghanistan on a secret mission to go and investigate strange lights in the desert, and they come across these, essentially Indian Vimanas, the Vimanas of folklore and legend, of Indian mythology, and, they kind of find these otherworldly beings, and it's this very mysterious, conspiratorial, sinister, spooky film. And I also asked the director, Daniel Myrick, some questions as well, and he told me that, he was directly inspired by Eric von Daniken and the literature that he'd read as a teenager, and absolutely, it was all seeded in there, so he was directly inspired by the stuff that's already out there. Many others have said exactly the same thing. However, I know I'm saying this is a cultural process, but at the same time, Race to Witch Mountain did, of course, have covert CIA input, and so that does have question marks over it as to what exactly the CIA did and did not do with the script. Andy Fickman told me that their CIA operative, who was acting in an off-the-books capacity, did make script changes, did request that certain ufological content be removed from the script, but wouldn't specify what.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, what didn't they want us to know?
So, yeah, and of course, you know, and the CIA advisor there actually designed the alien language that appears in the flying saucer at the end of the film, which is a bizarre thing for a CIA advisor to do. I mean, that goes way beyond their remit of offering impartial advice on matters of accuracy and authenticity. Why on earth is the CIA designing alien language for a film? I've got that on my blog, you can see the symbols from the film. You can check them out on the Silver Screen Sources blog, and I wrote an article about that. But
I
don't
weird.
Know there's necessarily that much to read into it, but it's certainly interesting.
I can only come up with two possibilities, that he's sort of a weekend warrior artist of some kind, that the guy finally had his chance to get his art in there, or some kind of message of some kind. That's what I would assume, but I'm naturally conspiratorial. But part of me says, you know, that maybe it's a message in alien language to the aliens, and they'll watch it and see it. And
there is a very loose resemblance between the symbols that he designed and certain imagery in some crop circles, but that's very, very loose. And the authenticity of those crop circles themselves is debatable. There's also some Morse code type stuff in there as well, which I've put on the blog, which he designed, which looks almost exactly like Morse code. Part of it is blacked out, strangely. Redacted, looks like.
Oh, man.
And then the rest of it looks like Morse code. And I've deciphered letters, but no words, because it's not actual Morse code. It's something that's like Morse code, but not Morse code. And you can decipher certain letters, but nothing else. So it could mean absolutely nothing at all.
Yeah.
It could just be for design purposes. But it's interesting.
Yeah, it could just be something. Yeah.
It's probably that's, nothing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Could just be something that was seeded in the film just to keep us busy trying to code it. So who knows?
Possibly. Or, I mean, who knows? Who knows? But, you know, so it's certainly an interesting subject. There's lots to get your teeth into on the UFOs and Hollywood front. As I say, what I'm trying to do with the blog and with the book is really just to encourage people to more actively engage with Hollywood's depictions of UFOs and ET life, because, and really, you know, to question how and to what extent our own understanding or lack of understanding of this phenomenon has been shaped by Hollywood entertainment. Because I think when we really start to think about that, we think, oh my God,
yeah.
That's quite worrying. You know, we really should disengage to an extent. Engage, obviously, with the content. Try to understand what messages are inherent there, how those messages might have formed, whether it be culturally or conspiratorially. Just be active spectators, and then to try and kind of think, well, if anything ever does go down in terms of release of information, we need to kind of put all of our cinematic memories to one side and try and look at this with fresh eyes and think, look, what we think we know is probably very far from the truth.
Yeah, I'd like to think that people would, though, be okay, like, that they would be able to separate fact from fiction, although...
I would like to think so.
Yeah.
I would like to think so. But I don't think we would. I think even I would have trouble separating fact from fiction, and I spend all day every day studying this.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have trouble separating fact from fiction. So I think we all need to really start to more actively engage with Hollywood UFO movies. The idea of the book is that it serves as kind of a reference so that it's useful before and after disclosure. I do actually believe that there will be a disclosure type event. I have no idea what form it will take. It will probably be nothing like we expect, but I just find it inconceivable that we will, you know, that in 60 years' time, other people will still be sitting here having this debate about UFOs. I find it inconceivable.
Yeah, yeah. I have mixed emotions. I'm kind of in your camp in the sense that it seems inevitable that it's going to happen, but I'm just so frustrated with the with the waiting it out part, and also nervous, because what if it happens? You and I are like the same age practically. What if it happens like in 30 years? You and I are going to be in our 60s, close. You know, it's going to be just like I was on another show, and I don't know. I mean, when I was a kid, I thought maybe we'd be able to go into space, but at the rate they're going now, I don't think I'm going to get the chance now.
Well, you got to ask why we're not. Why space travel isn't more freely accessible?
That's because of the UFOs, I think.
I would presume so. I mean, there's an awful lot of classified technology that goes on. I mean, take the UFO issue out of the equation. You know, private science is going to be vastly ahead of public science anyway, just from a defense and security perspective. So, you know, there are all sorts of problems that open up when space travel becomes, you know, freely accessible to the public. That's a security nightmare. especially if you put the UFO issue in there. So, yeah, that's an interesting one.
Again, though, you know, I'm hopeful for the disclosure, but I think the forced disclosure may be the only way to really for them to get out of this mess.
I agree, absolutely. I think it will be forced. You know, what I mean, we're getting off into a slightly different discussion here. But on the disclosure front, it's become such a loaded word, disclosure. But I do think that there's no way that this kind of classified material can come out without doing irreparable damage to certain elements within the power structures of the world.
Right.
Like just completely shattering damage. You're going to see. Look, from my perspective, the biggest fear that the powers that be, shall we say, for lack of a better term, have regarding UFOs is that they will be caught with their pants down, that something will happen, an event that's beyond their control. And let's face it, all of it's beyond their control, ultimately.
Right.
Something will happen, Independence Day style, or hopefully in a nicer way, Close Encounters style.
Yeah.
That's undeniable. That has tens of thousands of witnesses, hundreds of thousands of witnesses, captured on tens of thousands of cell phones, videos, goes on YouTube immediately, Fox News, CNN, they're all there on the scene, and there's no way to suppress it, and it's there. That's it. Done. What happens then is that very quickly, once we get over the shock and terror or elation, what happens then is, en masse, we go, hey, US government, or respected governments of the world, you lied. Because you said all this time that you never knew anything about UFOs, but here's one over the city, so therefore you must have known about them. And then we go, well, what about Roswell? What about all of these other incidents that have said to have occurred over the years? You know, what do you know? Tell us what you know. You've lied to us. Why wasn't this technology shared with us? Why do we have a different world as a result of it? We want answers. We want to lynch you.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, well, I don't think that's necessarily realistic, but that's their fear. You know, they fear for their jobs, potentially even for their lives, you know, if this information comes out, because they are, you know, to blame, or they're not to blame. And to be fair, they're in a very, very difficult position anyway. You know, you've got to sympathize with them to an extent. They're in a very, very, very difficult position. So what do they do? Well, there's not a lot they can do once their pants are down and they've been caught with their pants down. What they can do in advance is try to manipulate our perceptions of the phenomenon. They can try to manage our perceptions of the phenomenon. And what they can do is try to absolve themselves of ongoing complicity in a current cover-up. So, and I actually think we're seeing signs of that. And we've been seeing signs of it for the last few years. What you've had over the last 5, 6, 7 years is governments around the world releasing UFO files. Granted, not spectacular UFO files, often quite mundane ones, but releasing UFO files, thousands of them, to the public through Freedom of Information Act and sometimes just, you know, of their own volition. As I say this, today, as I speak to you, the UK government has just released another batch of UFO files.
Yeah.
Canada's done it, New Zealand's done it, Denmark's done it, pretty much half of South and Central America have done it, and are now speaking very openly and actively about UFOs.
Everybody but America.
Everybody but America, and that's extremely telling, because of course they have the most to hide, and they can't tell a little bit of information, because once you open that door, it all comes bursting out.
Right.
So they're in a real pickle. And what can they do? I mean, it must keep them up at night. You know, the handful of people who have information on this, I'm not saying that everyone does, of course they don't.
Yeah.
The handful of people who do, it's the stuff of nightmares. And their worst fear is that something happens that makes them look like they're complicit in a massive cover-up, and that they've been deceiving us, and that they've never offered any information. So what these other governments have done, and it's very clever, what the UK government has done, for example, and I've watched this very closely being here, is they've started to speak out much more openly. They've started to, the mainstream media has started to cover this subject much more seriously than it has done in previous years. And every few months we're getting batches of thousands, hundreds of, hundreds of UFO files, all of which are being reported in the mainstream media and having news reports on BBC. And it's what it's doing is it's getting people used to the idea that the government, over the years, has taken UFOs very seriously. They haven't ignored it, i.e. they haven't been negligent in their duties. They haven't been ignoring what could potentially be a defense threat. They've assessed the phenomenon, but they've concluded officially that it doesn't pose a defense threat and that there's no direct evidence that it's extraterrestrial. So they've looked at it, they've not been negligent, we stress this, don't accuse us of negligence, but we've found no evidence of it. Here are our files, we've given you thousands, this shows to you now, in the here and now, that we are not concealing any information. Everything we know, you now know. Don't lynch us when this happens. That's what they're doing. I'm convinced of it, and it's happening around the world, and it's happening everywhere but America, because they can't do it, because they're in this really bad situation. So I don't know what the hell's going to happen, frankly, but it is going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's you know, like I said, I was hopeful when I first got into this, but ufology tends to, it's impatient, I guess. I don't blame ufology for being impatient, but at some point...
It's impatient. It absolutely is. And you could waste your whole life away, you know, going, oh, it's going to happen tomorrow. It's going to happen tomorrow. You know, I don't necessarily even want it to happen because, assuming that, you know, there is something to this it, you know, it would be so disruptive on so many levels that it's very tempting to just think, oh, let's just go on with our lives anyway. You know, it's quite distressing to think that the life that you know could be hugely disrupted for many, many years or forever as a result of an incident that occurs, you know, in one day over a couple of minutes. And so I don't know. It's very interesting to debate and discuss. Do I think that we will know vastly more about UFOs and their occupants, assuming there are occupants, and I think the evidence shows that there are. Will we know more about this than we do now in 5, 10, 15 years? Of course we'll know more because the passage of time will take care of that. But will we know vastly more? Yes, I believe we will.
Well, that's a bold statement in a sense because I've always bemoaned the fact that I feel like we haven't learned anything in the last 60 years.
Well, no, that's a fair point. We haven't ultimately learned a great deal. We know little. What we learn is little details.
Yeah.
Testimonies amass, and a fuzzy picture emerges, and the picture is still fuzzy after 60 years. I agree, there's not a great deal that's been learned. But what I'm suggesting is that I think that the acquisition of knowledge on this subject will accelerate quite quickly, at least within mine and your lifetimes. I just find it inconceivable that it won't. All of the signs politically point to it.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting situation, too. You know, you talk about how the U.S. is in a bind because of the cover-up, and it's like, this has been going on for 60 years, so theoretically, we're either in the second generation or the third generation of this cover-up. So you hope that, I've always talked on this program, that disclosure is sort of a generational thing, as people like you and my age get older, and then we have kids, our kids are going to definitely believe in UFOs, and it's going to keep getting more till the overwhelming population just accepts it. And you wonder also if that happens on the other side, on the cover-up side, if they, you know, they don't see what the big deal was that they had to cover this up back in 47 or whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You hope that maybe that's what's going on their end.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. I mean, it's, as I said, I mean, to be honest, what I've just said to you is as explicit and bold as I've ever been on this subject in a public forum. I tend to be very reserved about the issue of disclosure and even the nature of the phenomenon itself. But, I mean, anyone who's ever read a substantial amount of my work will certainly get the strong impression of, you know, that I consider UFOs to be extraterrestrial, not necessarily exclusively extraterrestrial. I know a lot of people get into debates about yes, they're not human, but they're definitely not alien. Well, you know, it's kind of a, it's such a crazy debate having anyway. I mean, you know, look, let's just stick with aliens for now because at least there's some scientific basis for their existence, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But we don't know about, you know, beings from the inner Earth, or we have really very limited understanding of what another dimension even means, let alone what beings could inhabit it and why they'd be coming here. And, you know, time travel, again, is another explanation that some people come up with. Well, you know, the strongest explanation of all of the wacky ones is the ET hypothesis for now. So let's just, yeah, as a working hypothesis, let's go with that one and see what happens. But, you know, it's, as I say, it's a very important subject. I think it's going to become a bigger focus for the mainstream media in the coming years, even in the coming months. As I say, it's in and out of the media constantly now.
Yeah.
There seems to be barely a day that goes by now that a UFO story doesn't appear in a mainstream newspaper somewhere in the world, or a video report doesn't appear. You could argue that that's been the case for the last 60 years, but you know, if you study the subject, you'll notice that there really has been an intensity that's like, you know, incomparable to other decades, really.
Yeah, it's gotten better. It's the coverage of the media, coverage of UFOs has gotten a lot better since I've got in the field. Having nothing to do with me. What I mean is, you know, the giggle factor is still there, but it seems to be much less than it used to be.
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, if you look at polls that are conducted, they do, again, how accurate these polls are is debatable, but they do seem to consistently show that a majority of people believe in alien life, and at least half of populations of major countries believe in UFOs and believe that they're being piloted by extraterrestrials, and indeed believe that the government is involved in a cover-up. So there's a greater and greater acceptance of these ideas. And I suppose eventually you reach a tipping point. Something's got to give. There's all sorts of stuff going on right now behind the scenes, which, well, the fact I won't even, it's one, I've just done this really annoying thing where I say, I know stuff that I can't talk about, so I won't even bother.
All right, I won't press you on that one then. It's interesting in a way, because you suggested or said that you know, people in the UFO community kind of dismiss the Hollywood connection, and it seems like it's interesting in a way that, you know, the academicians and people in intelligentsia that you talk to, they seem at least more open to, hey, this is kind of an interesting thing to look at. But it's funny that the people in the UFO community sort of downplay it. You'd think that they would be all about it. But it doesn't sound like you're getting all kinds of heat from people about this, about your research.
No, right? I'll actually clarify. The UFO community certainly isn't down on the subject. Absolutely not. In fact, just the opposite. I think that people in the UFO community are really fascinated by UFO movies, by Hollywood depictions of it, but without, you know, putting too fine a point on it, most people completely fail to grasp what's going on. Because, you know, unless you've studied the industry or worked in the industry, it's very hard to know how the industry works, what types of influence are at play in Hollywood, how these films come to be. And so, you know, most people just read into them far too much. There's a tendency, I think, in the UFO community to automatically assume that every UFO film that comes out has an agenda, and that there's a conspiracy behind it, and that, you know, it's been directed by the head of the CIA.
Yeah.
I think that seems to be the tendency. And that's a shame, because it's not the case. But at the same time, I think that people are quite passive, even though they're obsessed with UFO movies. They watch them in quite a passive way. Whereas what I always try and encourage people to do is to watch films, any film of any genre, in an active way. Be an active spectator, engage with the film, try and figure out what influences are at play in the production process.
Right.
How long has it taken for the film to come to be? Who wrote it? What is their production history? What other films have they worked on? You know, do they have any links to powerful corporate or political institutions? And what does that tell us? Is there any bearing on the content of the film? These are the things I look at, and I just think it's important for people to recognise that, to step out of this aura of mystery that general and that UFO movies project, and to step away from that and to look at them for what they are, their products. And they are the product of hundreds of individuals who have worked on them. They are the product of corporations. Sometimes they're the product in part of government institutions. But they are, you know, they are in many ways influencing directly how we perceive and understand, or misunderstand the UFO phenomenon. And I just think that we really need to work hard to see them for what they are. You know, ultimately they are silly little imaginings, really. They look great. They entertain. Sometimes they don't. Battleship. You know, we need to see these movies for what they are, to step away from them, and to just recognize that, look, the reality of this phenomenon is almost certainly very different to what's being projected to us in celluloid form. And that's it, really. It's simply trying to encourage a greater recognition in the public that these films are powerful, they are influential. But once you understand how they're constructed and the influences at play in these films, then they become less mystical, and you can kind of step back and say, ah, I understand, I get it, and let's forget what they've said, because really it's not that important.
Yeah, exactly. It's about looking at the storyteller as much as the story.
Mm-hmm. Precisely.
Now, you've talked about, I'm sure people are pretty familiar with the blog, but talk a little bit about it, because you've got some great guests. Obviously, you've got some great stuff on there, and not just about, it's sort of like constantly keeping an eye on what's going on in Hollywood with these UFO movies. But you've also got some good articles there by yourself and a lot of guest writers, too. So I guess talk a little bit about, you know, what people can find there.
Well, I set up Silver Screen Sources, which is a blog looking at news updates, commentary, and articles on Hollywood UFO movies. I set this up in February of last year, and it's quickly become really quite popular. And it features fairly regular updates on what Hollywood is putting out in terms of UFO movies, UFO entertainment, TV series, films. It provides links to all of those films and to kind of keep people updated on how those films are progressing, reviews, how those films are received, commentary on those films from myself and from others. It also features a list, a very extensive list of pretty much every major or every important UFO movie that has been released since 1950 through to present day in chronological order, so people can refer to it. I've really set the blog up as a reference for people, so people can actually use it as a resource tool.
Yeah.
So they can kind of put the pieces together for themselves. It's got my definition of a UFO movie on there. It's got hundreds of posts that you can look at on UFOs in Hollywood, and it's also got a number of guest articles. I've got the likes of Paul David, Linda Moulton Howe, Nick Redfern, Grant Cameron, Jim Mars, Ken Thomas. You know, I've got Nick Pope and various other people on the blog, Miguel Romero. And so it's a very in-depth look, really, at Hollywood. There's a book's worth of material and then some on the blog. So it's all out there. It's access freely, and I'd encourage people to really spend a few hours looking at it.
Yeah, definitely. A few hours, a few days. It's exhaustive, folks, so you should definitely check that out. And, of course, you've been talking about the book that this work has spawned, obviously of the same title, Silver Screen Saucers. And I believe you said you're hoping to get it out in the springtime of next year, right? So I guess talk a little bit about what people can expect when they eventually get their hands on it.
Without giving too much away, it's going to be about 8 chapters. It's going to be an easily manageable book. It's going to be something that's not enormously convoluted. It's going to be split into themed chapters. So how I'm approaching it is, rather than write a strictly chronological narrative from 1953 to present day, what I'm doing is breaking it up into different themes.
Nice.
So I'm looking at, for example, a whole chapter on alien invasion movies, so both from a benign and, both from a quiet invasion and an overt invasion. So you've got the quiet invasion films like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and gosh, dozens of others.
They live.
These are the secret quiet invasion films where the ETs invade by stealth, and then you've got the invade, seek and destroy type ones where you've got Independence Day,
yeah,
and Skyline and hundreds of others.
Mm.
So the whole chapter on that, very lengthy chapter, and then you've got a chapter on benevolent visitation, so ET, Close Encounters, Cocoon, all of the films that have come out over the decades showing ETs in a more positive light. You've then got a chapter on, what have we got, abduction, ancient astronauts, disclosure, the idea of disclosure. I've got a whole film, a whole chapter on Hollywood's representation
nice.
Of secrecy surrounding UFOs, and then a whole chapter on encounters in outer space. And so it's kind of broken into different themes, but throughout all of these chapters, I'm weaving the actual history of UFOs. So the book is intended for people without any grounding in ufology. So it'll be of great interest to anyone who does study ufology or UFO literature, who is familiar with the subject. But it's also going to be for the person who's literally got no clue about UFOs at all. You can pick up the book and you will learn everything you need to know about UFOs and the history of UFOs through film. So it's
nice.
I'd say it's the story of UFOs told through Hollywood's representations of UFOs.
It sounds tremendous. I'm looking forward to it. There have been scant few books on the UFO Hollywood government connection. So it's time for a fresh look at this. So I'm looking forward to getting my hands on it next spring.
Yeah, it's been about 14 years. There's only been, to my knowledge, two books ever written on the subject, which is baffling when you think about it,
considering
how interested people are in the subject. There's only ever been two books written on this subject. Both of those were 13, 14 years ago. And so there's been a tremendous amount of films produced in that time. So you could write a book just about the films that have been released in the last 10 years. But this one will cover from 1953 to present day, but it will also be vastly updated from the previous two books.
Nice, nice. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Usually we end on what's next for you, but it seems like that is what's next for you, so.
Yeah, well, we're also, I mean, the other thing is I'm working with Bryce Zabel. Bryce is going to be writing the foreword for the book, and Bryce is also looking at adapting the book into a TV series.
Nice.
Either as a special, like a 1 or 2 hour special, or as an 8-part miniseries. We'd be looking at taking that to TV. So that's another project that's in the works.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I look forward to that as well. I hope good luck with that. It's a difficult road to travel down. But we need more good UFO TV, because there's nothing good on there on the TV now, so.
I agree. I'm actually not a fan of Falling Skies. I think it's very formulaic, very predictable, especially in this age of, it's not a bad series by any means, it's perfectly watchable, but I think in an age where you've got stuff coming out like The Walking Dead and The Wire and Game of Thrones and a great, great TV series, really sophisticated writing, Falling Skies is very safe, very formulaic, and it's a little bit naff, especially from Steven Spielberg, from someone of Spielberg's caliber who gave us such great stuff with Taken and Band of Brothers and other series like that.
Yeah, yeah. You wonder how much if he just put his name on it and walked away, who knows.
Mm.
Well, on that note, I thank you for coming on the show here, Robbie. It's been quite the conversation. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And like I said, I tried going into this without throwing 35 movies at you and wanted to sort of the movie discussion to happen organically. And I'm glad that that happened. And, we covered a lot of stuff that, I think people are really going to enjoy. And I wish you the best of luck. This is such an under-discussed and under-researched area of ufology that it's great that you're doing the work and you're carrying the torch and, you know, you've got the light on this thing, because if you weren't doing it, I don't know who would be, because nobody else even is taking a look at it, really. So, you know, kudos to you. You've done a tremendous job, and I look forward to, you know, your future output, because it sounds like, you know, you've got a real big fish on the line here, and it's exciting to see what's going to happen as this whole thing develops. So, you know, best of luck to you, and once again, kudos to you for your fine work.
Well, thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me on the show.
that does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to Robbie Graham for coming on the show and giving us so much time. For more insights from Robbie Graham, head on over to his website, www.silverscreensaucers.com. Check it out. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback, and this time around on the show, it is devoted entirely to our most recent edition of the program featuring Kendall Carver discussing the stunning spate of cruise ship crimes. This episode garnered a wealth of feedback from the BOA listeners, overwhelmingly positive reviews of the show from the folks who tuned in. Just a brief sampling. Kevin said, your latest show on cruise ships is one of the best shows you have ever done. Ken says, wow, best show ever. Great show, and keep up the good work. And longtime BOA audio friend Jason Offit simply said, effing creepy, dude. So many folks really enjoyed that episode of the program, and I'm very happy that it resonated with the BOA audio listeners to such a remarkable degree. And we got two lengthy emails from people with regards to the topic at hand, so let's feature their correspondences. The first one comes from Jet Magda. No hometown listed. Here's what he has to say. The Kendall Carver interview was one of the scariest I have heard in several years of listening to your great program. It reminded me of something I experienced on a cruise that I took with my sister in November of 2003. It was a Royal Caribbean Majesty of the Seas, 4-day Miami-Nassau Coco Cay Key West trip. It was the first cruise I was on that was rough from the very beginning. I didn't really notice it until the waiters started dropping their trays at dinner. My sister became seasick and went to bed early, so I just went on deck and walked around, but it was so rough that I avoided the rail. The next morning, I was back on the deck having a cigarette when a security person came around with a passenger printout asking if the smokers had seen this man. We all thought it implied a passenger had gone overboard, but there was no official announcement. It led to a complete change in itinerary with no Nassau, Coco Cay, or Key West stops. Jet Magda. So there you go, folks. There's sort of a glimpse, in a way, of some of the weird stuff that happens on these ships that the average passenger probably has no idea about. As our emailer just recounted, the whole trip got discombobulated, and no one ever found out really exactly what was going on. That is really part of the overarching story that we discussed with Kendall Carver. I would love to hear more tales from people who have had similar experiences or even more troubling experiences, and I'm sure Kendall would as well. Next email comes from Michael in Wales. Here's what he has to say. I am a longtime listener of your excellent show, and this last one shocked me. I turned 32 last week and have been on two cruises in the last 5 years, both to the Italian Mediterranean, both on the Independence of the Sea with Royal Caribbean. We did not have any problems and made friends with crew members, but I can tell you that there is resentment from them because many guests consider themselves better than the crew and act rude or shout at them. I have friends in Australia, India, the United States, and all over the world, so I learned respect long ago, but I could see some crew being pushed too far. Many of them are from poor countries, so witnessing gluttony on such a scale could be upsetting. Some staff admitted to me that they get as much as 80% of their wages from tips. They get around $200 a month and earn the rest through tips. My wife and I never had problems with any staff. We had a great time on both occasions, but I am alarmed that I knew nothing of this subject. I am sure many of these instances may have been the result of holidaymakers treating the crew like shit. I once witnessed a woman throwing a drink at a waiter because he brought the wrong beverage. But these companies are hiring people at slave wages, so they are likely to pick up some bad eggs. Given the lack of regulation, it's easy to see how trafficking could arise. It would be interesting to find if crew go missing or if there are patterns to the crimes. On a lighter note, I have seen UFOs whilst on deck in the early hours. Great show, Tim, and a nice break from esoteric subjects. Don't be afraid to do it every so often. No more cruising for us. Michael in Wales. Another fascinating email from someone with some first-hand perspective on these cruise ships. I've never been on a cruise and am kind of terrified to do so, having done the lengthy Kendall Carver interview a few weeks ago. But part of me also kind of wants to go on one of these and explore the whole subject even more, and kind of like Michael did here, befriend some of the crew members and get some inside scoops. But, again, terrified. I'm afraid somehow I'd besmirch one of the crew members and get tossed overboard, so maybe it's best to leave well enough alone. And just to get meta here for a moment, I really appreciate that Michael pointed out that this episode was a break from the usual esoteric subjects. If you're a long-time listener to BOA Audio, you know we like to break away from the paranormal every so often. And it is something I think that brings out some tremendous additions of the program. Based on the feedback alone to the Kendall Carver episode, I can tell you folks that it was equally compelling to the very best UFO, Bigfoot, and conspiracy shows we have ever done on this program. So stay tuned for more off-the-beaten-path esoteric-type topics here on the show, because that's the stuff that really fuels my interest in the unknown. We've beaten the door down on a lot of paranormal mysteries. There's still many, many more to explore, but there's also these remarkable stories hiding in the cracks, like the cruise ship crime spree that we discussed with Kendall Carver last week. And it's my job as the B in BOA Audio to find those stories for the outstanding BOA Audio listeners. With that said, let's seal up the BOA Audio mailbag this week. Big thanks to Michael in Wales for writing in, as well as Jet Magda for sharing his cruise ship stories, and thanks to Ken, Kevin, and Jason Offutt for sharing their high praise for the Kendall Carver edition of the program. If you would like to be a part of future installments of BOA Audio Listener Feedback, there are a myriad of ways to get in touch with me. Here are the big ones. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. Or go to binallofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the contact button. If you want something a little more interactive, you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. We like to call it BOA's Paranormal Playground. Lots of great discussion there on the world of the esoteric as well as pop culture. Additionally, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. Just punch in Binall, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, and that'll bring up my profiles. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And speaking of our online circle of friends, punch in Binall of America on Facebook, and you will find the official BOA Facebook page. It is there that I solicit input from the BOA Audio listeners on potential future guests and topics. If you want to join in on the fun, like us. We're at 800 likes. We finally crossed the 800 barrier, but I'd like to get us to 1,000 before 2013 begins. So if you have not yet done so, please like us on Facebook. Up next, let's thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. Since the last time you heard from me, we have two new columns at Binall of America. Regan Lee takes skeptics to task in her newest Trickster's Realm, titled The Prove It Game. And Leslie made her long-awaited return with an all-new Grey Matters titled, fittingly, Catching Up, where she updates us on what she's been doing over the last few months. And we've got a few new columns in the till from the BOA staff, so be sure to check out Binall of America for more insights from the BOA writers.
Normally, this is the time in the program where I would turn to the hardcore VOA audio listeners and ask them to make a donation to the VOA franchise, but I simply cannot do that since it's been a month since you last heard from me, and I have spent the month working at various gigs trying to make money. Seems kind of counterintuitive to ask people to make donations when I haven't produced anything for them in the last few weeks. So, hold on to your wallets, make a donation in a few weeks or months when we've provided you with even more BOA entertainment. I totally understand, and I would not feel right asking for donations when things have been cooking off-site and not at the BOA franchise. On the next edition of BOA Audio, we are going to embrace the creepiness that is the October Halloween season as we welcome Christopher Balzano and Tim Weisberg for a conversation on their new book, Haunted Objects, Stories of Ghosts on Your Shelf. Chris Balzano has appeared on BOA Audio a handful of times in the past, and Tim Weisberg is co-host of a very popular radio program here in the Bay State, which covers the paranormal and has graciously welcomed me a few times as well. So they are veteran investigators of the paranormal, and they're going to be discussing the haunted object phenomenon. We're going to try and unwrap that riddle. Are the objects haunted, or are they just tools of spirits lurking nearby? We're going to hear a bunch of cool stories about haunted objects and try and delve deeper into what is behind that mystery. Additionally, we'll talk about the state of ghost hunting and the nature of paranormal investigations. Turns into a spirited and lively conversation there at the end as we get meta on the world of ghost hunting. That's Christopher Balzano and Tim Weisberg talking about haunted objects, stories of ghosts on your shelf on the next edition of BOA Audio. That is the next scheduled edition of BOA Audio, but I should mention that we are on the verge, on the precipice of beginning some live programming from Banal of America. It's very early in the process. I would like to do at least one episode in October to sort of kick off the live aspect of the show. We're definitely not going to switch to entirely live, but we will be doing some live programming to fill in the gaps between taped episodes and to sort of bring a different flavor to BOA Audio. So stay tuned for more information on BOA Audio Live. And if you've got guest suggestions or concept suggestions for the program, shoot them to me via the means for contact that I told you about earlier in the show. And on that note, we close out this edition of the program. Big, big thanks once again to Robbie Graham. Big thanks to all the folks who wrote in on BOA Audio listener feedback. And enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners. You guys have supported this show through thick and thin. You put up with the interminable delays, which I greatly appreciate. And in turn, I try to provide you with the very best in esoteric audio programming. Thank you for your support of the show, and thank you once again for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.